Yes, I see it's, at least according to these machines, it is time for our session to start. So let's get started because we do have quite a few presenters and we have quite a lot of content to get through. So we want to make sure we get as much content as we want to discuss in the time slot we're allowed. This session is Configuration Manager 2012, the MVP Experts Panel. If you're not quite sure what an MVP is, that is the people on this panel. But an MVP is a most valuable professional, sort of a like an honorific that Microsoft grants certain individuals who are active in the community and provide assistance or help to people who are just trying to understand a particular Microsoft technology. In this case, it happens to be Configuration Manager. What we're planning on doing is each MVP will present one tantalizing little appetizer to hopefully whet your appetite for the rest of the sessions that you'll be going to throughout the week. It may be something that just wouldn't really make sense to have a whole hour and 15 minutes on, but just a 15 or 10 or even 5 minute session in just this appetizer is all you really need to know to be able to go and explore it on your own, but it doesn't really need a whole hour. And the other thing we'd like to do is please save all questions for the end because we do have a lot of content to get through, and there's a lot of demos as well. And remember, we're here all week. You'll recognize us, just come up to us. Everybody's friendly, everybody loves to answer questions and help or direct you to a blog or a website or anything to help you get your job done correctly.
Should I be the clicker?
Please.
All right.
So I wasn't going to introduce each one individually, so if you could introduce yourself, Kent.
Yeah, sure.
My socks.
Pretty nice socks. Thanks, Jason. Well, hello and welcome to the session. As Sherry said, my name is Kent, and I'm a Config Manager MVP from Denmark. My contribution to this session will be around role-based administration, and especially in those environments where we used to have multiple primary sites in CMO7. So in here, it's actually taken from a customer where they had a development environment. In CMO7, they had a separate forest for that. There was no domain trust, no nothing, up to the central side, and it works perfectly in Config Manager 07. And then they also have a QA environment, and they have a production environment. So in total, we had like four primary sites. That won't work in CM12. So when we did the migration, we had to rethink the infrastructure because in order to have multiple primary sites, we need to have Kerberos. We need to have a Kerberos trust, which we do not have when we don't have any trust between the two domains. So what we did was instead we migrated everything into a single site. But now I suddenly have the developers in the same site as the QA people and also in the same site as my production packages and so on. And that can be a bit scary. Not that we don't trust the developers, but since they're scripting and coding, if they just make one mistake, it could be a very long week. So in order for us to kind of accommodate for this, what we did was we came up with a nice little PowerShell solution, and the ingredients for this solution here is like four folders. So we need some folders, we need some collections, we need some security scopes, and we also have a single security role. So the entire purpose of this exercise here is to have a single site where I have my developers, and they will only be able to work with the packages that they're allowed to see. Once they are done, they will hand it over to the QA people. QA will then make sure everything is okay, and they will sign off and hand it over to production. And once it's handed over to production, the QA people are not allowed to do anything. They're not allowed to see the objects or to touch the objects any longer. In the beginning, this customer really wanted multiple sites. And I'm a huge fan of having a single site. And as Sherry said, we will be here all week. So if you really believe that you need multiple sites for your CM12 environment, please come visit us. And hopefully we'll convince you. Not to have multiple sites. So with that, let me go into my demo here. So the first thing I had, or we created, was just three different security scopes. So I have a developer scope, I have a production scope, and I have the QA scope. I created a single role. So we have a security role. We basically just use the normal application role that we have in here. And you can see I have a developer user, and I also have a QA user in here. If I go to my software library, we are a bit old-fashioned in this demo, so we are still using the packages. Down here, I have a few folders. So here I have my staging environment. Here I have my developers folders, the production folder, and the QA folder. And I've heard a lot of people saying, we don't need folders in CM12. They're a waste of space, basically. But you can actually use them. So you can use them to monitor the activity within a folder. You can also use them if you want to create some PowerShell scripts and change all the refresh schedules for all collections in that folder. So let's just see here. What I will do is just go to PowerShell. So we have a PowerShell script here. And I basically just turn on my monitoring. So right now, I will monitor all the activity that goes on in these folders there. Then I will just shift, can I please? Because now I will turn into a very, very cool developer. So I have the developer console here. And you can see I don't see any packages or anything like that. So as a developer, I will go in and create a package. We have a PowerShell script for that. And if you want to learn all about PowerShell scripting and so on, Kaido and Greg will do a session later. Right now, if I look in my, and I need to do a refresh here. It's not the best on glasses that I have. But you can see here, I created my package. I have a security scope. One of the thing about the default PowerShell commandlets that we have in SP1 is that they really don't honor folders. So in order for me to finish this, I really just need to move it down. If you want to learn how to create and treat folders in PowerShell, there is a Birth of a Feather session on Wednesday. But basically here, I'm the developer. I can see my packages. I will do all my cool stuff. And once I'm done, I'll basically just move and hand it over to the QA guys. Once I hand it over to the QA guys, I'm moving into a folder, and my PowerShell script will pick that up. I have a log file here that will tell me that it's removing, it's modifying. And if we look at the time, it looks pretty okay. So if I go back in here, go to QA, I don't see anything. That's because I'm the developer. So if I just remove my very cool hat here and then close down that, go into the QA console, and you'll see down here that I still have the package or the application. And if I just go in and add in the security scope, there you go, I have the QA security scope. So what we have here is a few PowerShell scripts. We will make them available, and Kaido, the author of the PowerShell script, he will blog about them. Make sure that they're available at the end of the week. And if you want to learn how to do this cool stuff, just make sure you attend Greg's sessions and his session, and also the BOF on Wednesday. With that, I will hand it over to the next guy, Johan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Being back in Vegas is absolutely awesome. I would follow this conference anywhere on the planet, but it's nice to be in Vegas as well. My name is Johan. I've been an OSD geek since I was about 16 years old, so that's what I do. And I'm going to share a bit troubleshooting tips, or a few troubleshooting tips that you can use to quickly find and resolve issues related to OS deployment using Config Manager. Now, in Config Manager 2012 SP1, Microsoft added in some, it's actually 9 variables, but it's only 7 that you actually can do something with, because the first 2 are read-only. But I will talk a little bit about them, and then I'll just simply dive into a demo about now on how to troubleshoot and debug your sequences. So I will jump onto my Hyper-V host, and I will go to an empty client. I will simply start a deployment, and while that one is starting up, I will show some things I have done on the server side. So I will simply mount the boot image, and I will start the deployment. In SP1, Config Manager is using, as most of you know, Windows P4. And not all hardware is compliant with Win P4, but most of that can actually be fixed easily by doing a firmware or BIOS upgrade of those machines. So not be too worried if a server doesn't boot Win P4. Just doing a BIOS upgrade and life will be good. All right, so WinP is starting up. And if I look on the server side, I have a sequence, or I have a few sequences, to which I have increased the default timeout for an error to occur. Because the default behavior in Config Manager 12 is that if something goes wrong, what it will do, it will abort the process, it will wait 15 minutes, and then it will just reboot on me. So, which means if I start a deployment of a machine, and then I go out the door and talk to Sherry for 16 minutes, then I might come back and I will see boot manager is missing. And the stuff that could help me troubleshoot that were in RAM and the machine rebooted. So I prefer to actually increase the timeout so I actually can see what's going on if something goes wrong. Also when troubleshooting, it could be efficient to simply add, say, a pause in the step of the sequence where you want to do the troubleshooting. So if I switch back to my client here, and continue, select that sequence. It will be this one. It will now kick off and start deploying that sequence. If you enable the command prompt, you can press F8 and you get the command prompt. And if you want to have it look as Kent did, a bit more developer-ish or old-ish, we can at least adjust it a little bit. Nice and green now. Microsoft added in CMTrace to the boot image in Config Manager 12, so you always have CMTrace. And with this, of course, you can read and open the log time, the log file in real time. So if I go to my X drive, Windows, temp, SMSTS log, I can now follow the log file. And you will see a lot of white lines, you will see a lot of red lines, and that's perfectly fine because it will highlight anything red that contains the word error. But it could be a folder named that, or it could be a report or status message saying something about giving me an error. But I'm receiving much more information in this log file than you normally do. And I also increased the size of the log file because the default maximum size is 1 megabyte. And a sequence can easily generate about 4. So to make sure I have everything available, in my Windows folder here, I have created, well, on my boot image, that is, an SMST's INI file, which contains the following lines. I'm increasing the maximum verbosity of logging, so log level 0 is the maximum. I have increased the size to 10 megabytes, and I have switched on debug logging. And that is why I get so many additional information in the log file that you normally would not get when you deploy a sequence. Now I can see it's formatting the drive and it's continuing all the actions down the sequence. And how do you get this file into the boot image? Well, you can do that when you create it. You can mount it afterwards, just do an ImageX mount or a Disk mount and just add a file. You can also copy that file as part of your boot image startup process. But that file needs to be present when this wizard actually kicks in. Because we are in WinP, I can actually access everything that the sequence is doing. So if I want to read a variable, if I want to do a review an object, I can do that. And in my sequence, I have an action that's running right now. It says use toolkit package. What it means, it's staging at this point files on the local drive containing all the MDT specific actions that I'm using in this sequence. So if I go to my E drive, which is the temporary drive letter I'm using for my deployment right now. I will have a VD package folder, which is my MDT package. And in this folder, I will have the entire MDT package, and I will have the scripts. And if I want to enumerate variables, I can simply run a script that will enumerate all those variables and dump them to the screen, where I can pipe it to a text file, and I can review the current settings as they are right now. And here, for example, you can see one of the 9 new variables, the SMST is Windows to Go variable. Config Manager SP1 can create the Windows to Go stick for you, for example. Now it has reached my pulse. And if I want to continue, I simply create a text file by echoing something to it. I try to type on this keyboard. It doesn't go very well. And the sequence will continue, and it will break. And it will copy the log files to the server, because I enabled that feature. And it will give me an error message. And as you can see, it's doing a somewhat fun countdown. So it will reboot in 24 hours and 1,400 minutes, which is also 24 hours. It's a UI bug, but never mind. But on the server side, in my logs folder, it actually copied the log files here, so I can continue to troubleshoot them on the server side. And when I want to dive into the log files, I can just open up and see them trace on the server, but this will be a static copy of the log file at that point in time. But sometimes you want to develop script that you run inside Windows. So let me go to a normal Windows 8 client. Here we go. And I will start a short sequence that will kick off and do its stuff. This sequence looks the following. It's a very short sequence that will do one thing only, and it will open a command prompt using a service UI exe component, which is part of MDT. But that will allow you to interact with the sequence while you're still running in Windows. So if you're developing scripts, instead of deploying the sequence 14 times until you get the script correct, you can just deploy this sequence once, you get the command prompt, and then you can run the script as many times as needed. You fix the script, you run it again until it's actually working. Now, before I jump back to that client, these are the new 7 properties in SP1 that you can actually change. This one is critical. It will determine to honor the setting, the drive letter that you have in your reference image. So if you created a reference image from the C drive, this one needs to be set to true to actually honor that value. These two are also new, of course, but they control, in the beginning when the boot image starts, it looks for policies to get the sequence from the server. You can actually add in a retry. So it tries multiple times, and you can define the interval between each retry. The download program is used by third-party add-ons like 1E, like Adaptiva, that's using their own content provider to download stuff instead of the default config manager thing. The language folder is simply the display language in your boot image. The persist content is to persist cached content on the client disk, and this one is simply allowing you to start something when the sequence has completed and still not being able to be part of the sequence, like a shutdown. Now, if I go back to my client here, I now have my command prompt started through service UI. And if I open up a normal command prompt and try to access something in my sequence, whoa. Like running a script that will read a computer object, it will fail. It will give me nothing because I don't have access to the sequence object. But if I go to this one and run the same script, it does have access to the sequence object. So while it's still running, I can test my script and run them one by one. And when I'm done, I do an exit. It will complete, and it will finish off the sequence. So basically, tips, tricks to help you reduce time when debugging scripts and troubleshooting sequences. All right, who's next?
Me.
Oh, should I remember that?
Yeah, whatever.
You want slides, man?
Yes, I'd like slides.
Slides?
Slides are lovely.
Can I be your clicker?
You can be my clicker.
All right.
If you want to be.
Which one?
No, just leave it there.
All right.
I'm not doing demos. I'm sorry, I didn't bring any demos. Because what I'm going to talk about is more of a philosophy.
We still love you.
I like you too. the philosophy I'd like to expound upon is the concept of very few collections. As you've perhaps started with SMS 2.0 in 2003, when you needed to get something deployed to a group of machines, you had to be very specific. You created a collection, and those were the boxes that was going to get something. You got a little bit more flexibility in CMO7 with task sequences because you could have a collection of 100 machines, but in your task sequences, you could have rules that would skip a step or include a step depending upon what the client evaluated as, like x86 or x64. I'd like to have you think more outside of the box, again, if you haven't already done so, with Config Manager 2012 and application deployments, and especially thinking of deployment types and all of the rules you can put on an application, you've put more of that logic at the client even more than you did with task sequences. So using user-centric and application deployment as your central philosophy of where you want to get to, try and think of whenever you get a new application or an upgrade that comes to you, can I send this to my collection of 500 machines, which might include servers and workstations, but it basically includes everything that is in a collection that is your scope of responsibility. But you set up your application so that if you only need to get it on 10 machines, it's your application rules which define whether or not only those 10 machines get it. So, and you might think that's a little scary, especially if you've come from the old versions of, I know my collection has 10 machines in it, that's who I'm going to hit. But as you know, we now have simulated deployments. And if you do a simulated deployment of that application against your collection of 500 machines with state messages, within an hour, you get back, okay, out of my 500 machines, 10 were going to install it, 2 said they don't need it because they already have it, and the other 488 say, no, not applicable to me, I'm never going to even bother to try. So using that as your philosophy, try and think of keeping your number of collections down, because in the long run, I'm thinking of you're going toward a state-based image. If you do get a new employee in, or you do get a re-imaged box that comes in, you don't have to wait for inventory and collection refresh before that particular machine is targeted with whatever that user deserves. So try and keep that in mind as you're slowly getting it closer and closer to the client and almost instant deployment of applications that a new machine might deserve, or they maybe get added to a new, you know, moved from one OU to another. It becomes more local to the machine of when something is deserved. Now, I know you might be thinking I'm crazy, because I'm thinking of you just need one collection. That's all you need, just one big collection, all systems. I know that's not true. There will be times, especially as you're going through this transition, when you will need collections, and you will need to have those collections be a target for a specific deployment. Maybe there's some application that just is not quite yet ready to be in an application deployment type, and you still have to make a traditional package program and advertisement. Or it is a sequence of 12 things that you have to do in a task sequence, and you have to target to a specific collection. So I know you are still going to have those situations, but whenever you do get something, like the next thing, or it's an upgrade to something, try and think of it before you just immediately go to doing what you've always done for the past 5, 6, 10 years. Can this be an application? Can I target it to my 500 computer collection and use a simulated deployment? And that's my go forward from then on, that it's, that's how it should work. The other thing too is you will probably need device collections for your custom settings. Maintenance windows, if you have them. If you're using endpoint protection, you might have to have different rules, so you have to have collections so you can target them with different things, and other custom client agent settings. Another thing I wanted to bring up was, I saw this just a few weeks ago. I don't know how I missed it until a few weeks ago, but Kenny, a fellow MVP, has a PowerShell script out where if you're thinking of user centricity as your guiding force, he has a PowerShell script where every time you run it, it checks your Active Directory, looks for groups, and creates a collection for you with a manual entry of that user group. So if you create a new user group for the new version of widgets, you now have widgets 3.2 that you need to deploy, and you target that to users in a user group, somebody creates the widgets 3.2 user group and Active Directory. If this script is running on a schedule, you will get that collection available to you to be targeted if you're going to deploy to users in a user group. I did talk to Kenny actually just an hour ago, and he said he's going to post an update to this script probably within the week, because right now this script takes every group you have and creates a collection for it, and he's going to let you have more logic in it, like only groups that start with CM underscore or whatever you decide is your filter, so that you don't get every user group created as a collection. So the other thing I was trying to think of is if you're thinking of this whole philosophy, I haven't heard it lately, but do you guys remember 2, 3 years ago there was some kind of buzzword about the golden image? Everybody wanted the golden image, and it's like you can never attain that because something changes every 5 seconds. But if you're thinking of this whole state-based computer that you'd have, this would be a way to kind of promote that you could have a golden image, because you could say, this is the end state. The end state is this is how the computer needs to be, because I'm using applications and all the logic behind the deployment types in an application model. And I hope that was helpful, and I'd like to ask the next MVP up.
Can you hear me?
Hello, hello.
I didn't have time to do a voice check earlier. There's a whole bunch of us, so I'm glad to be here with these MVPs. They're all strong, and they have committed ideas on cool things to do. I have some opinions this year that I really want to push everybody into. First off, who am I into? Who am I? Brian Mason. I work at Wells Fargo. What I'm about to say is not necessarily the opinions of Wells Fargo. My first opinion is that my best teammate here is Sherry Kissinger, and I'm happy to work with her.
Yep.
So before I get started, I'm going to ask everybody who runs Scorch to stand up and get out of here right now and go check out this licensing session that's going on at the same time. I don't know who scheduled this, but if I weren't in here right now, I'd be at that licensing session. I wrote a blog post last week or the week before on Scorch licensing is not maybe what we thought it was last year. At least I'm getting information now that if you're using Scorch to make a runbook that's going to make a collection in CM that's ultimately going to touch some of your computers, you're going to need a enterprise CAL for each computer or a client suite license, and that can be expensive. So you might have been getting really automated, and you can be really excited about Scorch, and this is awesome, and also you're going to get a big bill next year when you true up or something. So that may or may not be true, and the only way you'll know is if you go to this this session at this
other room. So yeah, we really won't be offended if anybody needs to get up and go to a licensing session.
In fact, if I disappear at the end of my part right here, you guys will know where to find me. So one of my passionate about this year is people offloading SQL, taking it off Box. I know that's a recommendation that people, Microsoft in particular, has been pushing at a certain level. You're going to get performance gains just by taking SQL off Box. I know Greg has even done that. He did that in CMO7. And sometimes you just have to, but you don't always have to, and there's things you can try first. And one of them that I like to do is just take the load of SQL off. Don't take SQL off box, but take SQL's load off, and you can do that. One way is really cool with MP replicas. These guys use an old-fashioned transactional replication that you can put up in about 15, 20 minutes, and they'll take a little snapshot of just the amount of information that a client needs to know to get policy, and it'll drop that onto a little database, and your MP will have this tiny little install. Let's say it's about a 3-gig database. There's no babysitting. This is kind of a set and forget kind of thing. Since SQL 2005 has been really rock solid, and I've been using it since SMS 2003. We go so long between problems that we have to like even look up a cheat sheet when we have to put replication back on because something broke, because it works that solidly. And what it's doing is taking the load off of your primary. It doesn't have to answer every single one of you asking me for policy, and I've got to answer you individually. Hold on, you know, I'm busy doing inventory, I'm, you know, trying to do your reporting, and now all of you want policy. My MP can't answer that question, and if I'm a primary and I go down, clients stop getting policy. But if I take just this amount of information that you need to get policy and I put it on you, my MP,
then I will reply to all of your requests for policy while he's off getting backed up or rebooted or whatever.
Or working on inventory or reports or whatever else, right?
Yeah.
So what's in there? Just these are little snapshots of how you can see exactly what's going into that database. It's really small. It's about 3 gigs. Size varies based on how often you're doing custom settings or you're doing policy or you're doing how many ads and packages you have. But it's about 3 gigs, and that's pretty small. So if you have a primary MP that says, let's say it has 8 gigs, you can put 4 gigs of memory into SQL, and all this stuff just runs live. Clients will get nice, fast, instant answers. And you can see this screenshot showing something like, where's my WSUS server locations? That's the kind of thing a client's going to need to know, package locations, all that. They can get that from this replica. And your primary can cool down and work on other things. SUPs, you can offload that SUP role. That's nice to get off that primary because scanning is a hard load. But offloading that isn't quite so simple. We don't get that nice little transactional replication thing to go to a SUP. You're basically going to install WSUS on your SUP, and you're going to have to tell it whether or not to use a database locally or a shared one. And if it has one local, the cool thing is it's kind of like that MP scenario. Any one MP could go down, a primary could go down, but people are still getting policy. It just doesn't work that way with a SUP. If you have a SUP and you put that local database on it, that's the only one it's ever going to use. If you put it somewhere else on another server, all your SUPs are going to use that shared DB. Now that shared DB is a single point of failure, and if he goes down, people stop scanning. Does that matter to you? I don't know. But it's something to think about as you're building it, because there's an important thing to know about what they've done here with SP1. If you're going to have multiple SUPs and you don't do that shared DB, and any one of your SUPs goes down for 4 hours, your client's going to get so mad about it, he's going to give up talking to the one SUP that he was married to for life. I liked you so much, you're the one SUP. And we were going to stay together, and you left me.
I'm sorry, Brian.
I give you 4 hours and you're not going to answer me, so I'm just going to go to someone else. Well, at least we're resilient. That's cool. I left you for someone else in 4 hours. That's how close we were.
But I like you too, Brian.
But there's a big cost to this. It's horrible, actually. If you switch a SUP, every single client who switches one can eat up like 4,500 megs. They have to do a whole brand new scan, and that's kind of scary if you have lots of clients or if you have a lot of clients and small locations. So it's something to think about. It really makes me kind of go back to the idea of thinking you can still do NLBs. Those are still supported. They're not out of the box. You have to use PowerShell or something like that. Well, guess what? I'm probably going to learn whatever that little word, what that is, because I think I want NLBs. Because an NLB is one name. And if I can't talk to one of the servers in that cluster, I still know that one name, so I'll just switch over. The NLB will pick up a different stuff that I can talk to. And I can do my normal small scan, and that, there's not going to be a big loss of network there for me to have to switch over because I kept the one name. And there's no right answer on any of those things. The number one right answer is that stuff isn't on your primary, that you've offloaded that kind of load. But you do have to think about where you're going to put SUP, either local or on a shared DB. I'm going to go into detail on this tomorrow with my session with Kent. And we'll have some demos, and I'll actually do that MP replica. You can see how fast and easy it is. Sounds scary to get into SQL and install your own database. You'll see. It's pretty simple. And with that, Kim's up.
Yeah, I liked you for 4 hours, too. And now I like Kim better.
Just like that. My name is Kim. I came up also. I'm one of the other Config Manager MVPs from Malta. I'm going to present a starting little topic on, well, something probably most of you guys have at least already seen. Topic for this session is why Walt is wrong. I don't know, it's like swearing in church, right? But my session is on why Walt is wrong. There's a little pointer there about NOPA versus CM tricks. Okay? Walt is never ever wrong, or suddenly wrong. He's wrong about NOPA versus CM tricks. All right. So how many of you know CM tricks? All right. That's like just about everybody, right? So why Walt is wrong about CM trace? The obvious ones. Right? CM trace make log files more human readable. Right. Well, people might disagree that Notepad makes them readable as well, but for most human beings, CM trace kind of helps making it more readable. Johan already stole a little bit of my thunder. It has simplistic error and warning highlights. Right? Simplistic because we just, if we see the word error or fail, we'll mark it red. If we see the word warning, we'll mark it yellow. That's roughly what CM trace can do. And then we have the uber cool feature. It auto-scrolls your log files by so that they're no longer readable because they scroll by too fast. Right. You can pause that. Right. That's the obvious reasons why Notepad is better than CM trace. Right. However, there's some less obvious ones that make Notepad better than CM tricks, right? And the...
What?
Yeah, less obvious ones. The real me. Okay? And I've basically built this session, or I came up with this particular topic, because we had a customer case where the customer wanted to do Config Manager 2012 AppV deployments, yet they had roaming profiles enabled. Right? Oh, okay. AppV deployments, roaming profiles. What's the big deal here? Well, the big deal here was that when they had their deployments up and they created required AppV deployments to user would log in to the first workstation, and obviously the AppV application would install. They would log in to their second workstation, nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. We didn't filter on primary users, we didn't do anything. The AppV application didn't want to install on the second device, nor the third, nor the fourth device. Right. So we've started troubleshooting this. And what we actually started up doing to figure out what was happening, which mouse is this actually? I have to run it off the laptop. All right.
This one here.
This one there?
Yep.
All right.
Lots of demo machines.
We were here, right? Right. So what we ended up doing was, obviously when you do troubleshooting, you start Configuration Manager CM Trays. And what I ended up doing to try and troubleshoot this was opening the log files, but not just any particular log file. I decided to have the four log files that I was interested in, and you might not have noticed or not have used it much, but CMTrace has this. And that's the real meat to CMTrace. This tiny little silly checkbox called Merge Selected Files. And what that does is it just opens the log files, yet it opens them all together in one single view, and it merges them based on the time and dates in those log files. So you actually get to see what your system is really, really doing. Right? And by doing this, what we noticed that in that particular case, that prior to installing a required application, your log file would actually go and run a detection method. And that's another thing you can do, which is pretty cool in CMTrace, you can filter. And what we learned is that the detection methods from an AppV deployment is actually based on a tiny little command line tool that's part of AppV that's called sftmime.com. So every time a detection method for a virtual application needs to run, what it does is it runs this command, sftmime.com query, and then a particular application. Now remember our case in point where we had the roaming profiles? What sftmime.com actually does is it looks at your registry keys to see whether the application is in your registry hive for that particular user. Starting to see the catch? Roaming profiles, this thing just looking at registry keys? That's what happened. Right? It looked at the registry key. It was installed on the very first system. User logged off. Roaming profile got saved. Looked into the second station. The registry key is already there. I'm done. Detection method says the application is there. I'm not doing anything. Right. What we additionally learned by comparing two different set of situations is that the case in point we had actually only was a problem for required applications. Right? Required AppV applications and roaming profile. Not for available AppV applications. Again, we learned that because we basically compared two sets of log files. And once we started counting the number of times we saw this sftmime.com running, we noticed that in a required application, it was checked one more time than it was in an available application. So for an available AppV application, apparently, and the only way we would have ever known that, in an available AppV application, we're not checking the detection methods when you click the application to install. For a required AppV application, we do. And that's why it failed to install. It didn't fail. It just refused because it thought, I'm already installed. Right. So that's why we use CMTrace. And trust me, I'm now explaining this in, 6 minutes by now. It took me half a day to figure it out. But I would have never figured it out without CMTrace. Right. So I already showed you CMTrace and the merge selected log files and the filtering. There's an additional checkbox in here that's called Ignore Existing Lines. All right. And what Ignore Existing Lines does is if you open those same log files, it shows you a blank CMTrace. Isn't that nice? Well, the blank CMTrace actually eliminates all the entries that are in your log file at the point in time you open them. If something is added to those log files now, it'll start adding them. Right? So merging selected log files and ignoring existing lines are incredibly useful for tasks you can trigger on the client side. Because you can now do anything on the client side and trigger it, and it will show you everything that is added to those particular log files after you've opened them. Right? Everything else is cleared up. Right? So that's the ignore existing lines and the functionality, right? And that's what I like so much about CMTrace and why I think Wall is wrong about CMTrace. Right? There's one tiny additional thing I was going to say on these CM trace things. One of the questions we get from new people and experienced people with new versions every single time is, yeah, I love CM I love the logging. I don't know any particular product that is better at generating log files than Configuration Manager, but oh my God, there's many log files. And oh my God, which one do I need to open? Well, there's a simple answer for that. There's actually a shortcut that is within CM Trace that allows you to open the particular log file you actually need at that particular point in time that works together with those merging selected files. Okay? And that particular keyboard shortcut that you should remember is called CTRL-A. And that will open that one log file you actually really need at that any given point in time. And I will show you. With that, I'm out. Over to the next. Have fun, guys.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
We'll see if that finishes before my demo has to start on the machine. Thanks, Kim. A little more information about Kim. You can see he's going to be involved in several sessions later this week as well. My name is Greg Ramsey. I'm a configuration manager. I can't even say it now. Configuration manager, MVP. I work at Dell, and I'm going to talk a little bit about extending the console and leveraging PowerShell to make your job a little bit easier. Just a little bit of a teaser today. Kaido and I have a presentation tomorrow. We're going to dive into this in more detail. We're going to focus on two things here. Simulated deployments and managing DP content. Who's currently using applications and deploying with simulation to make sure you're good to go before you deploy? Okay, good. Good to see some hands out there. Who says there's one thing missing from simulated deployments? Right, just one. Right, I want to take that simulation that I know works and I want to promote it to production, right? I don't want to have to go through the process again to create that deployment. So that's what we're going to do.
Thank you, Greg. And Kaido.
Yes. And yes, Kim's logs successfully loaded. I'm not going to close it for fear of what might happen right now. Okay, so in the Config Manager console, I just want to point out a couple of things here. Actually, we'll talk about content status first, and then I'll show you simulated deployments. So you can see my content, and obviously you can see some information here. Who's always wanted to, or who has had the need to hit redistribute from monitoring, and obviously you can't hit redistribute on a package application. Okay, maybe just me. That's okay. So I added a couple right-click tools. So now there's a manage content button on the actual content. You can see I've got a few of them there. You can hit validate, so it'll actually run a PowerShell script to validate the content on every DP that you're targeted, as well as you can see the other ones there. Send to DP group as well. Sometimes you realize you didn't target all distribution points. Now you want to hit a DP group. I'm just going to briefly show you some of the steps that are required to do that. So we've got an XML file here, and I'll quickly show you the path as well. It's just in your admin console installation. You can see, probably not in the back, there's a little bit of a path that you have to create. I'll post this on my blog as well so you can see it. Each right-click in the admin console has a GUID associated with it. And then you basically just drop an XML file in each one of those GUIDs for information to appear. And I'll just show you an example here on validate content on all DPs, for example. Or actually, I'll use redistribute package since we have that open. So you can see here the name, redistribute. You can see here the command I'm calling. And also, I have an argument on PowerShell called execution policy remote signed. This allows me to execute this specific PowerShell file without having to modify my entire PowerShell configuration. One thing you don't see in here, but it's important to know when you're writing PowerShell scripts, Configuration Manager console is an x86 application. So we are launching PowerShell in an x86 environment here. It just so happens when you're doing the right clicks, you're launching it in the right environment. And Kaido and I will talk about that more tomorrow. And you can see I'm specifying the file. And then there's some additional information in the SDK that'll tell you specific information you can pass that's kind of embedded in the console, the site server and the namespace and the package ID. Once you have that, then it's a PowerShell script. Not too complicated. A lot of this is kind of canned information. We're grabbing some arguments. We have to connect to the provider. This is an interesting one to start with because I'm actually connecting to WMI instead of running PowerShell commandlets because not all actions that you need to perform are available in commandlets today, and Kat and I will point those out tomorrow as well. But basically, we're just going to loop through all the targeted distribution points for a package and force a redistribution. Quickly, I'll flip over and we'll just show the simulation and I'll discuss that as well. So under deployments, I've got a simulation. It's targeting all systems because we all like to target all systems in test, right?
It's the right way to do it.
You notice another handy right click there, delete deployment, right? That's good too. I need a red button. So you can hit promote. We just pop a little GUI here. We've got to do some stuff here before we can actually promote this. We're actually querying to get the information from Configuration Manager on this simulation. There's a rule with Configuration Manager. I can't target the same application as a simulation and a deployment to the same collection at the same time. So we're actually gathering the information, removing the simulation, and then creating a deployment with the same information in it. We're going to give you a little warning, and then we'll say press enter, and then we're promoting it. And we're done. And magically, with an F5, now you can see we've got it required. So that's great. There's a lot of things you could do with that, and obviously it depends on your environment, how you want to handle that. Again, some XML is pretty straightforward once you've done it once or twice. Within this script, I set a couple defaults, but you can obviously change it to whatever you want. So I set my available and required time to today at 8 p.m. I might extend this further and maybe give you a date picker or something like that. We'll see how things go. Definitely open for feedback on any of that. And like I said, there's a little bit of work. We have to get the collection. We have to get the information. And we have to make sure it's an application because you can only target simulations with applications. We make sure you're sure. But really, you see we only have a couple lines here in PowerShell. We have to remove the deployment, and then we create a new one with the start CM application deployment. Pass it the information that we received from the simulation, and we're done. So pretty straightforward. Like I said, a little bit of canned code at the top. But all in all, it's pretty doable. You can see I've got a couple sessions later this week as well. And let's pass it to Steve.
Thank you, Greg.
Good job. Can you hear me? Excellent. Hi, my name's Steve Thompson, a Config Manager MVP, and was SQL Server MVP before that. Several things that I'm passionate about, those that know me, reporting services being part of it. And so there's actually two things that I think I'm going to present today that I think are important to know. First being, I think, somewhat of a public service information. But how many of you have custom reports? I assume most of you are using SQL Server reporting services. I see a show of hands. And how many have custom reports that you've created? Excellent. And of those, how many are backing up your reporting service databases? Very few, but I see a few hands. Excellent. Highly recommend that. It's one of the things that's not backed up as part of the standard site maintenance database task, so you definitely want to back that up. Another common issue I see with reporting services is the database recovery mode is typically set to full as a starting point. And I'll show you that in a second. If it's set to full, it means the transaction log file is going to capture every task, every report, every action that's taken against that database. Well, inevitably happen is the transaction log will grow to be very large. So that needs to be set to simple. The third topic was the report I showed a couple of years ago, but I've since enhanced and I'll make it available after this MMS. And that's what I call reporting on reporting services. Reporting services itself has a lot of rich information in it.
The information is captured for 60 days. It's configurable. You can extend it beyond that point. What it gives you is the ability to know who's running reports, what reports are running, how long they run. It gives you a lot of good information about what's going on in the background. And what I'll do is I'll talk about the next item, and then I'll go in and show you this stuff. The other thing I'm kind of excited about is something that I started working on a month or two ago with Greg. And we found the need that we work on a lot of different clients, a lot of different sites. So we go in and look at database installations, configuration manager installations. And as you can imagine, they're all over the place. You know, some are set up one way, some are set up another way. And so one of the first things we wanted to do is to be able to like document those installations, take a look at how the database files are laid out, how the database configuration options are set up. And I happen to have a lot of interesting SQL Server scripts to give you that information. What we didn't have was a nice automated means to pull that all together. We'll enter PowerShell. What we ended up doing is basically taking those various scripts, wrapping them in a PowerShell wrapper, and then running them on a SQL Server. And it's using the SQL PowerShell provider to give us a lot of information. And once we started getting that information back, we found that we were able to start identifying issues that were in the environment. And then the third step is, once you've identified, is how you remediate it. And I'll be covering that Wednesday on my session. Won't be able to get into it today, so a little bit of a teaser. And the session, by the way, is Wednesday, 12 to 1:15, and I'll be releasing these scripts and also the report I'm going to show on my blog. Sorry about that. I had to re-log on here. So reporting services. I mentioned the backup. And if you don't have a backup set, one of the easiest way to do that is to set up a SQL Server maintenance task. Okay, I'm not going to go into that right now. But what I will show you is reporting server itself. We right-click the database name and then go to properties. And then we'll select the options. And notice the recovery mode on this one is set to full. And that's where you change it. So what we do is change that to simple. Click OK, and you're done. It'll save those changes. Now we don't have to worry about the transaction log growing to something extreme. The other report, and basically I created an extract, and this is dumped it into Microsoft Word, primarily because I needed a VPN. And also some of this information I'm going to show you actually had our user credentials embedded in the report, so I couldn't really show that to you. But the default is it will report on a one-month period of time, set from whatever current date is minus 30 days, and you can extend that to 60 days. The report will provide report execution count by day, and you can see by that graph it gives you a really nice rendering in terms of the actual activity. It'll give you the top 10 most frequently executed reports, and that's a particularly handy one to know, because if you find that there are reports that either users say it's starting to run slow, it might be something that you can look at to tune. Also, a top 10 reports by person is an interesting one to know as well. And also unused reports. It gives you the opportunity to go in and perhaps clean up reports that are not being used. And this is a dump I did of our report actually a couple of days ago. And it'll show you that you basically get the graph. It gives you the top 10 most frequently executed reports, along with the number of times that they're run. The overall time it runs, the amount of information that's being brought back. Top 10 reports by person, username somewhat sanitized here. Also, it gives you an idea of what people are running and who are running them. So it gives you an opportunity to follow up with somebody if you suspect that perhaps there's something either they need to know or perhaps they're doing or misusing. Unused reports, and you can see these, it gives you the complete list. You'll find that probably there's several pages of reports that you can decide to remove or not. So this is, I think, kind of a useful report. Okay, so moving into the SQL Server and the PowerShell, we have we actually have two components to this, and I had thought at one point about possibly combining these into one script, and it could certainly be done that way. However, the reason for this, and sorry about that, the reason that we left them as two separate scripts. So the first script will basically run the SQL Server commands, if you will, the Transact SQL, and dump them out to CSV files. The second phase is to collect that information back to a single directory and then run a second script which compiles those into an Excel workbook. So that way we can look at them individually. And the reason why they're not on one is sometimes you need to run them on servers where obviously Excel isn't installed. Okay. So just to show you, and this is, we've tried to make it easy to use. There are a couple of parameters that you might need to change. One is the directory here. Right now I've got it set up to run to temp. The other thing is the database name variable that you see here. We've defaulted it to basically look for a name here where it starts with CM underscore, like most Configuration Manager. But this will work with Configuration Manager 2007. All you have to do is change the database name variable to be whatever that name is in 2007. And then what it does is it goes through and runs a series of SQL steps here. And one of the things I like about this particular process that we've done is it is indeed extensible. So as you find you need to add additional scripts or get additional information from SQL Server, you can add it. In fact, within the last couple of weeks, I added another one for database statistics, which I will talk more about on Wednesday. Between database statistics and index fragmentation, those are two factors that can cause significant performance delays on your database. So this is basically a script. I'm not going to run it because we don't need to sit here and watch it run. But to show you the SQL audit command, let me zoom on that, that you use to run it, is it's running the SQL SQLPS, which is the SQL Server PowerShell script. It dumps it into the temp directory, and then finally we compile it. And let me show you the output very quickly here. And what you end up with is a series of tabs here with the information presented in a very easy to use manner. And I see I'm running out of time. So you'll have to come to my session on Wednesday to learn more about this. What I will tell you is that I had a client, one of my colleagues, we were having some performance issues. And after we assessed that there were statistics and indexes were defragmented and out of date, we implemented the second part, which is the remediate, a query that took 9.5 minutes to run, completed in about 12 seconds. So the performance enhancements and performance increases can be quite substantial. All right.
Check.
Jason.
Check, there it is. Before you leave, Steve, a quick thing. Obviously, my name is up there. I'm Jason Sandys. I'm from the great country of Texas. there you go. No Aggies in here. Are there Aggies? Yeah, there's a few. There's always a few, right? So Steve mentioned two things about the database for reporting services. Both of those things go for the operational database also, right, Steve?
Correct.
So the first thing he mentioned was the simple mode. Every now and then we'll go into customers who actually have full mode turned on to their SQL Server, and their transaction logs are getting big, and their disk, of course, fills up at that point. So bad thing, right? Simple mode is all you need for Config Manager. It's what the product team recommends, and it's what it actually should be. The second thing was about backups. So Configuration Manager 2012 actually added the ability to use a normal SQL Server backup, right? And so this is something that we've discussed with the product team, and it is completely sufficient. You do not have to use the built-in maintenance task anymore. So two kind of things that came to my mind as Steve was doing his awesome stuff.
Thank you, Jason. Excellent points.
Okay, on to my wonderful slides. I want to also piggyback off of one thing that Kent said. So Kent disparaged CASes. Does anyone out there have a CAS, a 2012 CAS? Well, there's a couple of people that probably should, and Garth, you just have a test site, so you're a slacker. I'm surprised I can see him all the way over there. But there's not a whole lot of people who have CASs, so that's a good thing. But, you know, Kent said if you're thinking about having a CAS or if you think you should have a CAS, come talk to us and we'll hopefully talk you out of that. So one of the last things that Brian said was that there's no right answers. Well, there is a right answer, and that's don't use a CAS. But once again, there's a handful of exceptions there, like slackers like Garth, but that's okay. So I'm going to talk, this is a little bit of a teaser. There's a couple of other sessions on this. So Kim and I have a session on Friday that I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail. Steve Rahi has a session on Thursday where he's going to go into all kinds of crazy depth of boundary usage. So anyone that follows my blog, anyone that follows the Config Manager team blog knows there's been a lot of hoopla around boundary usage over the past few weeks, I guess the past month. I don't know when they put that blog post out. I kind of started some of this a year ago, 2 years ago? Actually, Kim and I did a session a couple years ago that we started this on. And for the record, subnet boundaries are still evil, right? Regardless of what the product group has to say on that one, thank you, Kim, they're still evil. But there are cases where maybe you should use them. And that's really what needs to be clarified. It really comes down to a handful of things, though. It's knowing what boundaries are actually used for, and this is probably the biggest confusion point that's out there right now. There's really that three scenarios where those boundaries are ever used. You guys can pretty much read them on the slides up there, so I'm not going to do that. But the one in the middle there, the auto site assignment, is a big one to point out. And it really goes along with the bottom one on the right, right? Client reassignment. So this is another fallacy that falls into that why I should think I should have a CAS in my environment. Because it gives you a failover point, right? That's what some people think. That's a completely false thing out there. It's a misperception. Your clients aren't going to reassign themselves automatically because that's not what boundaries are all about, right? Auto site assignment means the first time that client comes online and starts talking to that management point. If I change a boundary, my clients are not going to reassign themselves. It doesn't happen. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of pain, both to get them over there during that failover situation, and then probably even worse, to get them back to that primary site, right? So that's not what boundaries are about, and that's not a valid reason to use a CAS whatsoever. A couple of other things out there. Selection of site systems, MPs, SUPs, right, has nothing to do with your boundaries. So don't go out and plan that you're going to have a DMZ and you're going to have a segregated subnet and you're going to have a subnet over in, you know, wherever, Shanghai, and you're going to put an MP out there and you're going to have those clients report to that MPE, that SUP, based upon the boundaries. Doesn't work like that. MPs and SUPs having multiples is only about high availability, nothing else. So the three types of boundaries. Now remember, in 2012 also, this is all pretty much applicable to 2007. But in 2012, we added boundary groups. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on that today. It would take entirely too much time. But you have a starting place of actual boundaries. So there's the three types. You can kind of see when and when not to use these. So the blog post that was put out by the product team about 2 months ago, it really focused on performance. Why? Because there's a huge performance hit to use IP range boundaries. It takes the database a lot longer to figure out where clients need to belong or what DP specifically a client needs to pull content from. Right, this is really about finding content. Site assignment only happens one time. Remember, it's essentially when that client comes online the first time. So even if you have 350,000 clients, it's only going to happen one time for every one of those clients, which is tolerable. It's not going to add that much overhead. But now when I'm going through my content lookups, now all of my clients, every time I push a new deployment, every time I push a new application out there, they're going and they're actually looking for their content. And so now when I have 350,000 clients checking in every hour, you know, because there's new content available, because you've just pushed software updates out there, because you've just put Adobe Reader out there for the 10th time this month, they're going to, of course, have a huge impact on an MP. Now, you can do things like Brian was talking about, right? You can offload some of that because you can have that MP replica out there. But that's still 350,000 clients doing a lot of those things. So there's always some give and take in that. But at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of overhead with IP ranges. So you got to think about that, and you got to make sure that you plan your SQL Server correctly for that. And hopefully, you can get away with potentially using one of the others. If you can have an AD site that's already well-defined, that doesn't have aggregation, right? That's kind of the evil thing that happens with AD subnets. Then that's not to say you shouldn't have them, right? The AD team's happy with you having aggregation. They don't care. They're fine with it. Unfortunately, Config Manager doesn't like having that aggregation. We'll talk about this a little bit more on Friday, the exact whys, or you can go look up the session from a couple years ago, and we can figure out why as I kick the bottles over. But you can kind of see the pros and cons. You can definitely pull this up, and you can consider these different things while you're planning your boundary strategy, or maybe replanning your boundary strategy. So how about some general recommendations here? So the product team kind of made me switch these up a little bit. They prefer 80 sites. In reality, 80 sites are kind of the easiest ones to use, right? If your 80 team's doing their job, how many people have 80 teams that do their jobs? There's actually, okay, I know there's lots of chuckling, but there's actually some people that raise their hands. So there's a hope, right, at least for, go talk to those people, right, that have that. Maybe one of those guys can come up here. So if they're doing their jobs, they're actually doing their subnets well-defined, then your job for boundaries is pretty easy, right? I'm putting my site codes in, and hopefully it lines up. Does it always line up with what my Config Manager infrastructure needs to be? That's another question. That's another reason that we all get paid money, right, is to go out and figure those kind of things. But if they're doing it, it makes our life a lot easier. IP range, once again, they're the easiest to use, in my opinion. All I need is a chart of all my subnets, right, and I don't have to worry about subnet masks. I don't have to worry about any of those other idiosyncrasies that come along with everything. But once again, there's a hit to be done. So the real thing when it comes to designing your boundaries is that bottom right there, that blue box. This is a threshold. Is it the bottom right? Yeah, it's the bottom right. This is a threshold that the product team has come up with. About 100 clients for every boundary. If you cross over that, so if you get to 100 or 99 clients in a boundary, you're probably going to start seeing some performance degradation. Is it a hard limit in any way? No, of course not, right? It all depends upon, you know, maybe you have an MP replica in there, and of course that's going to affect things. Maybe your SQL Server is really big, and it can handle that load. Well, of course, then you can break that threshold and probably go further. But that's just a general recommendation. Make sure you look at that. Make sure you understand that if you're going to do those ranges across the board, get as few ranges as possible. Don't spread them out. Don't have one for every little subnet that's out there, because you can aggregate your ranges when they're out there. If you know your subnet masks, right, then you can go ahead and use your IP subnets. And there's some people who've gone through the pain of making sure that they know all of those things. Go ahead and use them. The evaluation for them is really quick, and you're not going to have that huge overhead. So lots of little things to know in there, and you don't have to restrict yourself to one of them. If you know some of your subnets, go ahead and use the IP subnets, right, because they're going to be quick, they're going to be easy to do. But if you have those onesie-twosies, if you have networking guys that love to change things on you on occasion, right, and not tell anybody, well, you're always going to be having an issues there. But it's probably going to be a lot quicker for you to break things up in an IP address range, because they're probably not telling the AD guys anyway. So you're still going to have an issue there, right? There's kind of a balance. There's no perfect answer to this one. So you have to make the best of what's actually there. I don't think things are changing anytime soon. So it's about learning what each of the nuances is for each of these three types, figuring out what's best for your environment, and then, of course, doing some perf testing. At the end of the day, like all things in Config Manager, it's whatever works best for you, right? I can stand up here all day long and say something works the best for everyone, but if it doesn't work for you, who cares, right? So make sure you get it in your lab. Make sure you actually read the documentation, read the links. So there's a bunch of links in my session on Friday, and, of course, Steve will have lots of good information on Thursday of why you should and why you shouldn't do things. Be informed. Make informed decisions about these things, and don't just make assumptions about them. And it's quadruple zeros.
Yep.
So that means we are all out of time.
We are out of time, and we have a whole 45 seconds or so for questions. You should get them all in, right? If anyone does have a question, Johan does have some swag for, like, the awesomest question ever. So there are microphones there if anyone has any questions for any one of the MVPs, or there's, you know, other experts. So it looks like about 600 experts here that might be able to answer your question better than any of us. And, of course, we're available all week. Just find us.
Absolutely. And fill out your evaluations. There are a huge amount of evaluations. I guess you can win prizes. Everyone loves prizes. We're in Vegas, right? A little bit less of a gamble. You don't have to put anything in.
And have a good week here.
Thank you.
Have lots of fun.